seeing like people really criticizing Hillary Clinton and I think Barack Obama, because initially they hadn't supported gay marriage and then they changed their mind and did. And people, even liberal people, were criticizing them for changing their mind, as if we want them to hold prejudiced views for the rest of their lives, because they once did. And I think it's such a weird mindset, but it's so prevalent in our culture that we see this as kind of flip-flopping. We assume that if someone changes their mind, it's like they don't have backbone or they don't have conviction. But actually, obviously it is possible that people just change their mind to suit the kind of political wind, like just to, they're only thinking about their popularity. But I also think lots of people will just be changing their minds as they come across new evidence or as they've been persuaded to think about issues in a different way. And we should celebrate that rather than like punishing these people for having the decency to admit that they were wrong and that they, they now hold a different belief.
Hello and welcome back to the Supporting Champions podcast. I'm Steve Ingham, and if this is your first time tuning in, then you're in for a treat. This is where we explore the often invisible aspects of achieving greatness and aspiring to perform, whether in sport, business, or life in general. We're not just about the headlines here, we're about the fine print, the strategies, the setbacks, and the comebacks that make the journey worthwhile. And we talk to experts from various fields, from coaches and scientists to leaders and, of course, performers, those people who are out there trying. So it's not just about the performers. These are also about the people behind the scenes, the ones who are making champions what they are. This podcast isn't just for the elites or the top professionals. It's for anyone who believes in pushing their own boundaries, who believes in the power of progress over perfection. It's for anyone who's committed to improving, to learning, and to taking action. Whether you're a student, a professional, or someone simply interested in personal growth, there's something here for you. So if you're ready to dig deeper and apply some real-world insights to your own life, you're in the right place. The Supporting Champions podcast is sponsored by Athlete Now, a new venture I'm involved in. Now, Athlete Now is a new platform that's revolutionizing the connection between athletes and sports performance practitioners. We know that in the world of sports, the pursuit of peak performance is a constant journey, and it can often feel like a bit of a solo mission. And nowadays, with the high-tech landscape of wearables, nutrition, mental training, navigating your path to excellence might seem overwhelming. And Athlete Now aims to demystify this process, offering you straightforward guidance. So Athlete Now, or theathletenow.com, what's it all about? Well, if you're an athlete, then you know that the margin between good and great is influenced often by the expertise that's guiding you. But where can you find that expertise? Athlete Now offers the answer, granting you access to a curated selection of sports science, medicine, and coaching professionals. And they're not just qualified, but they're rigorously vetted so that you can search by experience, specialism, location, or accreditation to suit your needs. And Athlete Now is emerging as the solution for athletes seeking to push their limits and get the support they need. For the professional practitioners listening in, Athlete Now solves the age-old question, how do you stand out in a sea of talent? And the platform not only showcases your skills, but connects you directly with those who need them most. So whether you're a nutritionist whose strategies are fueling the champions, or a psychologist whose techniques are helping athletes to cope, strive, and perform, Athlete Now is your stage. For athletes, the platform is free, and for practitioners, you can sign up half price for this first year. Only £10 for the foundation tier, which will allow you to get your profile started, or upgrade for the professional tier, where you can get advanced features such as the jobs boards, community access, and practice guides. And that's just for £50 per year. So Athlete Now is more than just a directory. It's a community committed to excellence, ensuring athletes and sports professionals are perfectly paired to help support each other's ambitions together. So whether you're striving to compete or building a career, helping others do so, Athlete Now is really where it's at. So take a look at theathletenow.com. In this episode, I speak to award-winning science journalist David Robson. Now, David's insightful exploration into the realms of cognitive psychology and human behaviour have particularly been showcased in his books, The Intelligence Trap and The Expectation Effect. And in those books, he offers fresh perspectives on how our minds work, especially in high-performance environments. David's journey into science journalism has led him to uncover fascinating aspects of human intelligence and the surprising pitfalls that even the brightest minds can encounter. In this conversation, we explore some of the many concepts that David surfaces in his book, such as dysrationalia, a term that challenges our understanding of the expert mind and explores the balance between evidence-based wisdom and the ever-present risk of misinformation. We also discuss David's approach to identifying and navigating the minefield of lies and misinformation. And he needs to do that for his role as a science journalist. And it's a skill that increasingly is crucial in our information-saturated world. In The Expectation Effect, David examines how our beliefs and expectations can shape our reality, a concept with profound implications in the world of sports and high performance. We discuss the nuances of this effect, including the power of things like placebo, the importance of our mindset going into events, and the intriguing concept of eustress for longevity and performance. All right, David, well, welcome to the podcast. How are you today?
Very well, thank you. Yeah.
Fantastic. Now, I know that you've just finished writing a new book, which we can talk about maybe next summer, but I'd love to talk to you a little bit about, in part, your writing skill and how you craft the works that you've done, as much because I've really enjoyed the books that you've written, The Intelligence Trap and The Expectation Effect. We had a conversation about The Expectation Effect at the Cheltenham Science Festival, which was superb as part of a panel. You're an award-winning science journalist. How did you get into it?
So a little bit by chance, actually, but it totally made sense in the end. So I had always been kind of torn at school between kind of humanities and like English literature in particular and like foreign languages and then science, which I was always maybe slightly better at science than I was at the humanities. But, I also just had this kind of fundamental curiosity about the way the body works, the way the mind works, the way, the universe was formed. And so I had to make this choice at 16, when you're picking your A-levels, and that pushed me down the sciences route. And I ended up studying maths at university. And while I was doing that degree, even that was really, interesting, I realized just how much I missed kind of creative writing, thinking about language. And so then when I graduated, I was really kind of in another dilemma for what career to pursue, but I just randomly saw a job advertised to be a news reporter at this small kind of technical scientific magazine. And so I applied for that. I was really surprised to be interviewed and to get the job. But as soon as I started out, I just realized it kind of totally clicked for me. Like, I loved interviewing people. I loved like crafting a story, and I've never really looked back. So from there, I moved to New Scientist and then the BBC, and then I started writing my books. And, I've loved this trajectory of moving from being like a news reporter to thinking and kind of creating on a much bigger canvas with the books to kind of tell, like a big narrative about an area of science. But it's like, for me, it marries those two kind of interests that I've had from when I was very little.
And does your mathematics background help at all? I'm curious as to whether you've just shelved it or whether it's useful.
I mean, it does help on a couple of levels. Kind of prosaically, it helps for me to just understand statistics, like to understand when a result is reliable. you know, whether it's likely to be replicated. You know, that fundamental literacy has been really important. And I did kind of, during my degree, specialize in statistics. So that's absolutely helped when I'm like looking into medical research or psychological research. But also, like, I think, strangely, I think there are quite a few analogies between mathematical problem solving and writing. And I can only describe it as being, you know, when you're at university level maths and you might have this problem to solve that's going to take, like, you know, hours or the whole day for you to solve, and you're having to juggle so many different ideas in your head at one go and like pursue lots of different avenues of thought, some of which are going to be dead ends and others are going to be more fruitful. And I get the same feeling that I had during my degree when I'm, you know, planning a feature or planning the structure of a book, that actually that was really good training for me to be able to, I guess, think abstractly, but also to just like, it was a training in the creative process, even though the two disciplines couldn't seem to be more different.
That's interesting. And when did you feel like you could go from that transition of articles through to books? When did you think, I'm interested in writing something more substantial than perhaps something that someone might read in a few minutes?
Yeah, I mean, that did take a bit of a leap of faith. Like, it definitely wasn't, I wasn't certain that I'd be able to do it. I mean, it was just, I guess, while I was working at the BBC, I'd come across a lot of research on intelligence and the problems of the ways that we define intelligence, and then, you know, other abilities and traits that might be useful for better decision making. And it just felt too big for an article. And actually, it felt right. Like it should be, you know, you really, to understand it and to be able to apply it, you really needed, you know, to paint this research on a much bigger canvas. And so that's when I thought, like, really, I do want this to be a book. So I approached an agent and she helped me to craft a proposal, which was 30,000 words, so about a third of the length of the final book. And I think that process really did prepare me then to write the whole book, because I'd already started thinking about all of the narrative techniques I could use to kind of draw a reader through, you know, from page one to page 300. In some ways, writing a book is a bit like writing a sequence of feature articles, but obviously you do need to have those different narrative threads that are going to carry people from the beginning to the end. They can't each be kind of separate, independent pieces. They have to carry the same theme and the same characters sometimes to get people to really engage with the material.
Okay, so that's interesting in itself. That's a journalistic technique or a writing technique that I'm not familiar with. I mean, I haven't written a book, but I've probably got away with it as much as anything. But that's a deliberate act of being able to select material, identify topics that resonate throughout, that build momentum as you go. How do you form that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a real headache often. I'd say
it's the mathematic formulaic problem solving.
Exactly. Well, I mean, for my first book, I found it a real headache. And then for my second, it fell out kind of in place as soon as I started planning it. I think that was the nature of the material. But for the first one, yeah, it was difficult because you don't want to be repetitive, but you want to be able to, you know, you want your readers to be able to remember kind of how the different chapters are interlinked and how you're building that argument. So one of the big challenges for me was to just provide those little reminders and signposts to let people know kind of where you're going and to remind them where you've been, but without making it too kind of formulaic, or you don't want to have those signposts kind of glaring in each paragraph, because that can actually be very irritating for the reader. But yeah, it's really, I guess, the fundamental process is putting yourself in the mind of the reader and thinking, like, what are the main questions that they're going to ask, you know, having read what they've just read, and how can I then address those and move on the story in the way that I want to get to the kind of final, you know, end point of that narrative.
Yeah, and I mean, you've got lovely phrases there about painting research on a bigger canvas. Is that something that you have in mind about what's the final effect of my writing? You're thinking about the end reader as opposed to your stream of consciousness or how you've interpreted it. Is that something that you're training all the time, or is something that you're naturally feeling?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it is intuition, I think. Like, I guess that is from my experience as a journalist as well, those 15 years of just kind of developing an intuition for when something's working and when it isn't. And, you know, all of my writing, but especially my books, go through so many revisions. So I'll write the first draft, revise it kind of, you know, a few days after I've finished that one chapter, and then I'll revise it again a few months later, and then again kind of once the whole book has been written. So it's like a process of refinement, I guess. And the advantage of leaving those big spaces of time between writing and revising is that I can approach it afresh as if I'm a reader who's not so familiar with the material. And that's when I find like those gut feelings kind of really kick in, that just tell me, like, you know, this section, which I thought was really interesting when I was writing it, is actually too much of a distraction. Or that, you know, and then, you know, at the final kind of revision, when I'm reading the whole book from beginning to end and revising it, that's when it becomes more apparent that actually, you know, two chapters might have this kind of harmony, this kind of resonance that I hadn't noticed before, and you want to make the most of that. Or that actually some, you know, two separate sections might feel very discordant. And when you were writing them independently, you didn't notice that. But when you're coming back to the revisions, you notice that actually they jar too much in, like, perhaps the tone, you know, the style of storytelling, or in the material itself. And then you have to find some way to kind of tweak them, readjust them, or even rewrite them to get them to produce the effect that you want.
Mm. So it sounds like it's a reflection, but a structured sort of routine of you doing the work, setting it aside, coming back afresh, reviewing, and then your own sort of creative processes and review. And how much of that is informed by your sort of editor shaping your own writing style previously?
I've definitely learned a lot from my editors. I remember for my first book, my editor had told me that I sounded too cautious in the way I was writing it. So, and I at the time I wasn't sure I agreed, because I feel like there are a lot of books where the author sounds supremely confident in what they say, and they've got like one message. I won't mention names, but they've got like one message that they hammer home again and again and again. And it often fails to acknowledge the kind of nuances and uncertainty that is sometimes inherent in the research. But then I felt like we came to a compromise with how I approached it. And actually I think there are always clever ways that you can incorporate those nuances into the narrative, but without sounding too hesitant, and actually making those kinds of uncertainties like an inherent part of the story. And I think readers appreciate that. They want to know, like, I could have said with the expectation effect, for example, that you know, you can create self-fulfilling prophecies that will benefit every single area of your life, and that you're, you know, I could have painted it as something a bit like The Secret, but a kind of scientifically proven secret. But actually, like, I think readers appreciated the fact that I was quite careful to say, like, it will work in these circumstances, but not those circumstances. And, you know, just I feel like it's a much more honest way of painting the research. And I think people respond to that. And it doesn't mean that you have to sound doubtful, but you just have to be very clear about which bits you are confident about and which bits you aren't.
I might come back to that, because I think
in looking through the intelligence trap that you're covering some quite controversial areas. It was potentially quite confronting for some people who might have fallen into these traps. I might come back to that in a moment if I could, but I'm just curious to sort of just finally ask you about your sort of writing process. Do you have a routine and a structure and a way in which you write, or do you wait for the inspiration, or do you every morning make a cup of tea and wait for the birds to tweet and then you're off at a certain mm-hmm. time? How do you go about it? Because I've got a sense that as a full-time writer, journalist, you have to do the work. You have to commit to it.
Yeah, I am quite disciplined. I wouldn't say I'm certainly not the most conscientious or organized person. But yeah, in terms of sitting down and carving out time each day to write, like I do that all the time. I kind of do create a schedule, at the start of the book to kind of know roughly where I want to be at each, stage of the process up to my deadline. I have bad days where it just doesn't feel like it's flowing well. And I have good days where it feels like it's flowing quite easily. But I do think my main error with writing the intelligence trap, which made it a lot more stressful, was that I kind of really wanted to know upfront exactly how a chapter would be structured. And then I felt like, I'd have this very intricate plan and then it'd just be joining the dots. That actually proved to be a big waste of time. I've learned now that once I've done the initial research, once I have a good feeling for how the argument is going to unfold, it's much better for me to just kind of sit down and write out a very rough draft and then spend more time revising that kind of after it's been written rather than over planning beforehand. And I think that's just that when you're talking about, even long articles, but especially something like a book, there's just too much for the brain to be able to hold all in one time. You can't preempt every creative decision you're going to have to make in advance. Sometimes you just have to write it and to see, and to make those decisions as you go through it rather than, having a blueprint, basically.
So it sounds like there's just trusting the sort of serendipitous creative brain processes that the connections are going to be made, and that you might be writing something and you don't know what comes next, but you then try something. And is there an irony here about, did you try and over intellectualize the writing of the intelligence trap?
Yeah, I think I did.
Did. You fell into the intelligence trap, didn't you?
Exactly.
Right, to the intelligence trap. That's an infinite loop. That.
I mean, I would say I've reached a kind of sweet point now. So I don't really think it would be useful for me to just sit down without any plan in front of me. But I think I just need a rough plan. I don't need a very detailed plan. And that's because if I hit a block while I'm writing, and it's and then I can just go back and do the research, the very precise research for what I think I need to kind of resolve that problem. What I was finding when I was doing the very detailed plan up front was that I was still having to do that anyway. So I just basically, and a lot of the research I'd done up front was just ended up not being part of the book at all. So it's just kind of streamlining that process. It's not a complete revolution in the way I write. I'm definitely not writing kind of stream of consciousness, but it is, yeah, you're right that I think I did over-intellectualize the writing of the intelligence trap and tried to be too systematic in the way I went about it rather than having more faith in my intuitions as I was going through the creative process.
Interesting. That's nice in itself in that it probably recognizes a great illustration of how some sort of formal structure and logical mathematical approach to something needs to be met with a more emotional or interpersonal or feeling based approach. And I think my my connection with the book is informed by just that, where I see great sports science practitioners, leaders, doing it by rote, and I've done an MBA in this, or I'm trying to follow a structured researching methodology, and I'm trying to work with athletes that are super complex individuals, but in a very unique context, and there's lots of moving parts. And I've seen both approaches of an intellect or an emotional intelligence be very effective. And
yeah.
And I've also seen both approaches not work, and particularly so on the intelligence side of it, where someone comes in and just tries to defeat everybody with their raw brain horsepower. What motivated you to write The Intelligence Trap?
I mean, it came out of my journalism, and essentially, like, I, you know, would come across a lot of stories while I was, you know, writing about science of these, you know, like amazing physicists who would then, you know, there was no doubting their intellectual capability, but then you'd hear about their, you know, private views on issues like climate change, for example, and you just think, like, you know, you're not looking at the evidence here. Somehow you're not able to kind of logically weigh up the evidence in the same way that, you know, most of your peers are. And I'll give one example was the Nobel Prize winner, Carey Mullis. So he was a biologist who came up with the polymerase chain reaction, the PCR that we used in our COVID tests, but actually has been really transformative with the whole of biological research. And, you know, it's used in genetic testing. All hospitals now will do PCR tests. It's involved in, like, the Human Genome Project. But he, like, his autobiography is so bizarre in that he denied that CFCs were causing the hole in the ozone layer. He denied that the HIV, HIV virus was the cause of AIDS. He denied that carbon emissions were causing global warming. He believed in astrology. He said astrology was better than psychological research for predicting human behavior. He thought he could travel to the astral plane. You know, it was just really striking to me that he could have had this flash of brilliance in discovering the polymerase chain reaction. But in all these other ways, he was a very irrational person. And so I really then wanted to understand, you know, what is it about intelligence, like, as we've measured it with, like, IQ tests, that we've been missing, that isn't apparent, that isn't capturing, you know, that kind of level of rational decision-making or belief formation. And so I looked into it, and actually there's been a huge amount of research on this exact subject, looking at how IQ is related to things like our susceptibility to cognitive biases and fake news and all of that. And what you see is that there's often not a strong correlation at all between someone's IQ or their academic performance and all of those other measures of rationality.
So that feels like that is similar to the title of your first chapter of The Intelligence Trap. Yeah. You know, that expertise can fuel stupidity. What's happening there? Why is that? In that, if somebody can evaluate PCR and assess the relevance and the appropriate specificness of that as a test for particular conditions, but it's unable to evaluate astrology against similar criteria.
Yeah.
What's missing, or what's present there that means that they can fall into those traps, as you put it?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, there's, you know, lots of things going on with someone like Carey Mullis.
not him specifically, but yeah. Generally then.
No, yeah, exactly. I mean, he is a good example of this. But, you know, there's so many others. It's like I talk about Arthur Conan Doyle, you know, a scientist and an amazing writer who, you know, shows he understands kind of logical deduction brilliantly with the Sherlock Holmes books, but then was also fooled by all of these spiritualists and mediums who were like defrauding him of his money. And he had friends like the illusionist Harry Houdini, who was actually a complete skeptic and, you know, was telling him like, no, these, you know, like he could say, like, I know how they're fooling you. They're doing it through these methods. And Arthur Conan Doyle's response was not to be like, oh, okay, like you've got a point. Maybe I'll adjust my opinions. Instead, he came up with this belief that Houdini was actually some kind of fairy being who was denying the existence of the paranormal to cover up his own his own truth about his past. So, you know, this is actually, you do see it in a lot of intellectual figures. And I think what's happening in all of these cases is that people come to form, most of us come to form, in fact, our beliefs quite intuitively. And then we have a very strong connection to that belief. It becomes part of our identity. In Arthur Conan Doyle's case, I think it was like, you know, the spiritualism was very important for him to help him to kind of cope with like the death of his son, for example. And then once we form that belief, we actually just use our intellect to defend the belief. And so someone who's more intelligent actually has kind of more tools at their disposal to form those justifications that are necessary and to demolish any of the arguments against them. So someone like Arthur Conan Doyle, you know, he was drawing on these theories of electromagnetism that were very cutting edge at the time to try to explain how, you know, the paranormal could exist at wavelengths that were invisible to the human eye, for example. So he was actually using his intelligence and knowledge there to kind of fuel that justification for spiritualism. The same with Carey Mullis. I think he was just, because he had this very strong, I don't know where it came from, intuitive belief that HIV wasn't causing AIDS, he was then, you know, analysing these scientific papers, but actually kind of creating very tortuous justifications for why the evidence was wrong and he was right. Someone who was less intelligent, I don't think would have been able to kind of, you know, create those that amazingly contorted argument that he was doing. So that's, in a nutshell, that's what it is in those cases. But I think actually, you know, we're all susceptible to this in the formation of our political beliefs, where we will justify our own party and, you know, knock down any political opponents, often in a very hypocritical way. But the more intelligent you are, the better you're able to kind of form those justifications again.
And my and let me ask this question first, because I've got a sort of an analogy in sport that might be relevant. But did you see that there was any association between certain personality characteristics that might map to this susceptibility to fall into, I guess, to a certain degree, sloppy or lack of evidence thinking? I'm thinking of open-mindedness, closed-mindedness as a personality trait. And that feels like if you are closed-minded, you might be able to stick to a particular view, but bend reality or bend the evidence or surface a limitation of a study that is stretching plausibility and lacking reason rather than staying open-minded. Are there any particular personality characteristics like that that you saw related to this trap?
There were, and I think that's a great example, because that is essentially what I'm talking about, is that, you know, you might have a very sloppy study that, like, would fail on all kinds of criteria, but someone like Carey Mullis might use that as the kind of keystone of their argument. And then they might take, like, a very robust study, and they might find what they think is one tiny error that for most people would not really it has no bearing on the conclusions, but they would like really focus on that and build their whole argument about that one kind of a chink in the armor. So that is the kind of thing that we're looking at here. And that's how you then, you know, it appears that you're building up all of the, you know, evidence on your side and knocking down the evidence against it, even though actually, like, objectively speaking, that's not the case at all. And so, yeah, there are absolutely the open-mindedness is a known personality trait. And this isn't just that kind of open-minded, like, oh, I'll try a bit of everything, but it's, you know, specifically designed with defined through these questionnaires that would ask people, like, do you take time to look for evidence contrary to your opinion? Do you acknowledge your errors and update your thinking when someone's pointed out a mistake? You know, all of those factors kind of come to form this personality trait of open-mindedness. And what you find is that people who are actively open-minded in that way, the people who really do look to find that evidence that might question their point of view and then treat it fairly, they are much less susceptible to this intelligence trap, which is called motivated reasoning, the one I'm talking about. Intellectual humility is another one. Curiosity is another one. They're all related, but can be defined, you know, in slightly different ways. But people who are curious, who just have this kind of real love of learning, you know, they always want to find out something new. They are immune to the intelligence trap, because if they find something that kind of questions their opinion or doesn't chime with their worldview, rather than feeling kind of threatened by that and feeling that they have to tear it down, they just think this is a new opportunity to, like, to learn something new, to get that kind of dopamine kick when they find out something fresh and interesting. And so they will actively pursue that. And, you know, that is so protective then against this motivated reasoning. If when you're confronted with something that doesn't make sense to you, you don't just dismiss it, but you actually, you know, dig deeper to truly understand kind of how that fits with what you thought you knew. Curiosity is something that we can cultivate. There's evidence in education that actually really little kids are super curious. They'll ask up to 100 questions an hour as they go through school, and the kind of rigid lessons that definitely in the past we had in school are where questions aren't encouraged. You know, question asking drops to one an hour or less by the time they reach, you know, junior school even. So it's definitely something that education could be trying to, I think we need to constrain or channel children's question asking in a way that can be productive, because obviously it can be a distraction in lessons. But what you don't want to do is actively discourage that curiosity to understand and to dig deep into something new that that you don't fully understand at the moment.
And I'd, you know, absolutely encourage that. I think one of the interesting observations I've done over the years working with sort of postgraduates who you'd think have got more sort of deeper reasoning, and when I've gone in and done like a little local school assembly when my kids are, you know, talking about science, and some of the questions that come from 8-year-olds, I think, wow, there's a level of creativity there that has just been squashed in a postgraduate pool.
Right. I mean, I don't want to dislike like certain degrees, but there is good evidence that, like, generally open-mindedness does fall the further into education someone goes, right up to kind of undergraduate degrees and PhDs and beyond. And if you look at measures of kind of critical thinking, actually, for certain degrees, like I think business studies was one, you actually find that critical thinking doesn't just kind of plateau, it actually decreases during the degree. So you have to question, like, what people are being taught and how we could, you know, change that, how it could be rewarded to be a critical thinker in those degrees.
Right. I was working with a CEO of a pharmaceutical company yesterday, and he's talking about the responsibility of gene editing techniques and how there are so many moving parts. The technology is moving so quickly that they don't know what the future holds. They genuinely don't. But they've all come from an MBA background, and they're all taught that it's this way in life. And there's a formula to it. And he was talking about just how important it is to be nurturing the curiosity and the reflective review and healthy processes to take the intelligence out of their experience, rather than thinking, here's a playbook that we can just roll out for a future that is unknown. So that's fascinating in itself.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that is why, like, learning to escape the intelligence trap is so important, because it makes us more flexible thinkers that can adapt. You have to be able to adapt your opinions and your way of working when you're faced with new evidence. But unfortunately, you know, with the intelligence trap being the way it is, lots of people, when something new comes along that questions what they're doing, they just kind of they become more entrenched. They react against it rather than, you know, updating and growing as a result of this new challenge. And, you know, I think, like, you know, going back to those kind of university degrees, I think sometimes we are rewarded for building a convincing argument, a persuasive argument, but I don't think the criteria that are used to kind of, you know, grade essays necessarily also always look at intellectual honesty for, like, you think the critical thinking skills that we would really want people to appreciate. So actually, you know, being even handed in your appraisal of the evidence for and against your case, for example. I think this is pervasive, not just in education, but in our culture. Like, it's, you know, there's a lot of emphasis on, like, being persuasive, and you're kind of not rewarded if you do. Actually, going back again to kind of what my editor had told me, you're often not rewarded for acknowledging uncertainty and incorporating multiple points of views.
I suppose the obvious area there is politics. We set out a manifesto 4 years ago, and we've changed our mind now. In light of evidence, this isn't a particular comment on any policy. But when someone's changed their mind in light of evidence, it's called a U-turn. And it's definitely a black mark against your decision-making. You've changed your mind? What? You know, as opposed to, why? And what's the evidence for that? And is that going to help us more in the future?
Right, exactly. I remember, you know, seeing, like, people really criticizing Hillary Clinton and I think Barack Obama, because initially they hadn't supported gay marriage, and then they changed their mind and did. And people, even liberal people, were criticizing them for changing their mind, as if we want them to hold prejudiced views for the rest of their lives, because they once did. And I think it's such a weird mindset, but it's so prevalent in our culture that we see this as kind of flip-flopping. We assume that if someone changes their mind, it's like they don't have backbone or they don't have conviction. But actually, you know, obviously it is possible that people just change their mind to suit the kind of political wind, like just to, you know, they're only thinking about their popularity. But I also think lots of people will just be changing their minds as they come across new evidence, or as they've been persuaded to think about issues in a different way. And we should celebrate that rather than, like, punishing these people for having the decency to admit that they were wrong and that they, you know, they now hold a different belief.
And I know I think it's a trap that I can see happen for a lot of people in my field, where the conviction with which you state something really helps buy in. If you're working with an athlete or a coach or a team, you say, this is the way that we should do it. This is what's coming up. This is how we need to approach it. You see them get a self sort of confidence of, actually, yeah, this person knows what they're on about. They're instructing, they're helping me go forward. When my scientific mind never really wants to fall into an absolutist perspective, it grates when I hear it. It grates when I think I'm going to do this. And an absolutist, we probably need to do this. It's a softer way of presenting. Mm. Probabilistically, this is the approach that might stand us in best stead. But it's maybe not as convincing. Maybe it's not, hasn't got the rhetoric of a politician, or it feels like it's persuasive. So it feels like a trap that you might fall into to make something happen, as opposed to any sense of causing doubt in someone else's mind. But it's probably a more mature way of working.
It is. And I mean, when you're overconfident, overly dogmatic, when you present a very simplistic solution to a problem, you're just overlooking it's never going to be the actual truth, basically. And so it's putting everyone at a disadvantage when you do that. Like you said, it's not a scientific way of looking at problems, because context is always going to matter. I'm not entirely convinced that I think we overestimate how convincing it is to other people when we present ourselves as being overconfident. And I think Vanessa Bones, who we were talking about in the pre-chat, a scientist at Cornell University.
That's right.
Yeah. I think she talks about in her book, You Have More Influence Than You Think, about the fact that, when you're giving people, say, dietary advice, if you are like, you must change your diet to these foods, or if you just suggest it, you might think about changing your diet to these foods, people are actually much more likely to take up the advice in the latter case, when you present it less forcefully, when you acknowledge, when you give people the autonomy and the sense that actually it's their personal decision, and that there might be other ways to go about their health as well. So I think we overestimate that. And especially in politics as well, there's good research showing that when you're talking to someone who has differing political beliefs, small like hedge words where you're acknowledging your own doubts and uncertainty about your beliefs and expressing curiosity in the other person's, that is actually much more likely to change the other person's opinion and to get them to consider your opinion more seriously than if you talk with absolute confidence and certainty.
I need to go back and listen to my own conversation with Vanessa to update. And evidence resistance, then, you've mentioned that as an idea, and that sense of suggesting that individuals in leadership, maybe high performance roles, perhaps to a degree of status, might have a greater resistance to evidence that contradicts their beliefs. What did you uncover in that particular chapter?
Yeah, I mean, it's very, obviously writing about politics is quite tricky at the moment, because I was always conscious of the possibility of offending whatever side you present, you're going to offend someone. And actually, I think like the intelligence trap when it comes to political disagreements is probably evident on both sides. I don't think the left or the right are any more or less susceptible to this. But it is very difficult for you to be able to, open your own mind and open other people's minds. I do think we should be, looking at the kind of log in our own eye before we criticize the speck in other people. So, we should be thinking about how we can become more open-minded ourselves. And one technique that I mentioned in the intelligence trap that we can use is this process called self-distancing. And that is applicable in all kinds of areas, but actually in the realm of politics, it's just really useful for you to try to imagine the perspective of someone who's not involved in this particular debate. So if you're talking about the US elections, for example, or the UK elections, imagine what someone in Iceland will think about the two candidates. Like, how would they appraise, you know, the strengths and weaknesses of those people? And what you find is that when people take that outside perspective, it removes that kind of emotional charge from the debate that can fuel that motivated reasoning, that form of the intelligence trap that causes us to become closed-minded. So when they imagine those elections from the perspective of someone from Iceland, they actually just become more open-minded, more likely to consider multiple perspectives, to, you know, admit their own uncertainty about these issues, to, to follow up with like a research, you know, on both sides of the debate. So that is something that we can do to improve our own thinking. And then in terms of like changing other people's minds or having constructive discussions, I think acknowledging our own uncertainty, it becomes a bit contagious, so the other person's more likely to do so. We should follow the what's called like the Montague principle, which is named after Lady Wortley Montague, who said that civility costs nothing and buys everything. Just be polite. Don't resort to kind of ad hominem attacks, because, you know, that is not only going to damage your own, it's not only going to alienate the people on the other side of the debate, it actually alienates people who are undecided, or even people, you know, who would be more likely to be kind of on your own team. Rudeness just never really pays in these kinds of arguments.
I mean, I love that quote that you surfaced from William James, saying a great many people think they are thinking when they're merely rearranging their prejudices. And that in itself provides you with just a little bit of a check and challenge to you. What am I producing? What am I, you know, I've assembled a thought, here it goes. And to at least recognize this is informed by my own personal experiences, my biases, from my point of view of an educational training route, social economic background. It's all a product of everything that I've been or experienced or come up with, as opposed to the reality or solving it perfectly as you might do in maths.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it is something that I'm consciously aware of personally. I mean, I don't really comment on politics on any of my social media because I'm so aware of that. But I don't also, because I'm not an expert, and I feel like people sometimes should restrict their output to their expertise. And I don't think anyone really would care what I think about these things. But yeah, I think it's something that we can all apply, is recognizing that fact. And it doesn't mean that you don't have to have convictions. There will be some things that you very strongly believe in. But even if you have that very strong conviction, you know, you might still want to update the way you see that issue, or the way you approach other people about that issue. I don't think any belief should be so strong that you are unwilling to shift even a tiny bit based on new evidence. And it's going to backfire. Like, if you might feel like, you know, showing your passion and your conviction is, you know, is the best way for you to achieve your goals, and that is a kind of sign of weakness if you have these conversations with people who disagree with you. But actually, it's only by having those respectful conversations that you're ever going to actually achieve the change that you desire yourself. And the only way you can have constructive conversations is to at least be receptive to other people's points of views and curious about them. So, yeah, it's something, I think, that William James quote really captures something that's so important for all of us. It's something that we should really live by, and that is that we should always be willing to question whether we are actually capable of changing our mind, or whether we are just rearranging our prejudices.
Was that part of your bullshit detection kit? Or maybe we should say degrees of bullshit, you know, because there might be some, you know, 99% bullshits and there might be some 85%. So yeah. Could you give us some of your top tips about how to recognize that misinformation?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of good research showing that if you actually teach people explicitly critical thinking skills, then they are much better at detecting bullshit and fake news and, you know, questioning conspiracy theories. But we're not taught those skills at school formally. I think the assumption was that we would pick them up just naturally with a good education. But, you know, they have to be taught with good examples. You know, it can be part of other courses like history, for example. You can have elements of kind of bullshit detection when you're discussing historical sources. So it absolutely, you know, can be integrated into our education, but it isn't at most in most schools or universities at the moment. But this, you know, bullshit detection, it's sometimes hard to apply, but like it is, you know, like any kind of literacy, it helps to have lots of practice. And that, you know, some of those skills are the ones we've spoken about before, just like questioning, like rather than just gathering the information that naturally fits your point of view, like try to look for a source that might challenge your point of view. So if you see a piece of fake news that, I don't know, is accusing the Democrats of having this paedophile ring around some pizza restaurant in Washington, D.C., you know, go to other sources to see like what they say about those rumors and, you know, be open to the fact that they might challenge this attractive story if you happen to be to hate the Democrats, you know, accept that. You know, other literacy skills are just like, you know, checking the sources, like how well established is this, you know, news outlet that you're looking at? Who's funding it? Why would it be in this group's interest to be selling this particular piece of news? You know, like often there will be lots of vested interest there. Recognize logical fallacies and the kind of tools of manipulation. A common one will be for people to kind of spread these kind of fake surveys where you'll see, you know, something like, well, first of all, like this was used in the tobacco wars of the 60s and 70s. So you would see these surveys showing that, like, you know, these 500 scientists all smoke and say that smoking is actually good for your health. And then it sounds convincing until you kind of look into the backgrounds of these people, and they might not be who've signed this petition, and they might not be scientists at all, or they're paid by the tobacco industry, or their expertise is not in biology or medicine, but it's in, you know, some obscure part of geology, meaning that they have no expertise in you know, how cigarettes could be causing cancer. So that was a technique that tobacco companies had used, spreading these kind of this false consensus, this idea of a false consensus, to be very persuasive. But you'll see that all the time now when you're looking at questions like climate change. There, you know, was a very popular or very widely shared poll that did exactly the same thing. It kind of had a list of supposed scientists who had signed up saying that they didn't believe that human carbon emissions caused climate change. And then you look down the list of names and you can see it was open for anyone to sign, whether or not they were a scientist, whether or not they were a real person. So you had like signatures from people like Dr. Jerry Halliwell of the Spice Girls. You know, it's very easy to create the illusion of a false consensus, but actually you would find if you questioned actual climate scientists, there's by far, you know, the overwhelming majority of like 97% of scientists who agree in the causes of climate change. So it's being aware of those kinds of manipulation techniques. And that's why I think having an understanding of the history of misinformation can be very useful, because once you understand, say, how the tobacco industry had formed, had tried to use that tactic for one kind of culture war, it's easy for you to then recognize when it's being used against you now for a completely different issue.
Yeah, and I can see why there's real quality in your writing, because you have evaluated evidence as you've gone, and that statistical background is critical for that, just to be able to pick up the difference between, say, a study that's found, say, going from 10 in 1,000 people who eat cherries and it reduces their cardiovascular disease, and it's gone up to 14 if you don't. So it's a 40% increase if you don't eat cherries. You know, these sorts of statistical manipulations that newspapers love, don't they? But it is a sloppy interpretation of statistics, or it's simply used to create clicks or to get attention or to present a particular view.
Exactly. And, you know, sometimes even organizations like the World Health Organization have been guilty of maybe not presenting information as responsibly as possible. I remember when they said they'd classified classified bacon as in the same category of carcinogenic products as asbestos. It's factually true, but eating bacon is not going to be as dangerous as eating asbestos. What they were talking about was that there had been enough studies showing that there was a statistical link between bacon and cancer to be put in that category. But what they were completely ignoring was the nature of the absolute risk that bacon was forming. We do know that bacon does increase the risk of bowel cancer, but like you said, the absolute change in risk is fairly small. I think if you had like compared like 100 people who ate no bacon at all to 100 people who only ate bacon, the difference would be one person getting bowel cancer, which is not to be ignored, but I feel like the public deserve to be told that particular statistic when informing their decision, because it might also be that someone just wants to have a bit of bacon once or twice, you know, a month, and then maybe the increased risk is not going to be so important that they need to worry about that. I actually think when we present health information, I'm not going to say dishonestly, because it was technically accurate, but I don't think it presented it with the nuances that we needed. I think when you miss those nuances, it's actually going to backfire, because people just, you know, they can sense when something isn't right, even if they can't explain why. And then they're less likely to observe that health advice, but also many other pieces of advice as well, because it erodes trust in the institutions. So, yeah, I think like, you know, the honest and nuanced presentation of statistics is something that we should all be striving for as science communicators. And I think we need to have faith that actually the public are intelligent enough to understand those nuances, and that they can then, you know, that we should be giving them those nuances to inform their own decisions, rather than trying to thrust a narrative upon them.
Mm. Yeah, I have a sarcastic slide set which says that if I have 7 hazelnuts, 1 mandarin and 3 cups of coffee every day, I'm going to add 27 years to my life expectancy, which, you know, and you could just go additive, couldn't you? When actually then if you have a couple of eggs, some rashers of bacon and some wine, and you're back down to net zero. So you haven't actually benefited. It sort of leads me on a little bit to your second book, The Expectation Effect. And I'm curious to sort of see if there's a link here in terms of the sort of information that is presented to people and their potential commitment and belief to that, that might provide them with a health benefit or a performance benefit. And we're in here about that concept of placebo as much as anything. But when you were starting to look into the resourcefulness that can be developed through your own mindset or how information is presented. What were some of the major things that really stood out in this area for you?
I mean, there's so many. The placebo effect, I think, was, you know, quite well known. But what really surprised me when I was digging into this research was just how much the research has moved on over the last 10 years to show that actually similar expectation effects, that basically is the same principle, that your beliefs about exercise or diet or the aging process are going to shape the outcomes. Actually, we do see that in all these different areas of life. It's affecting our health every day in ways that we hadn't realized. In the past, we've just thought that the placebo effect was relevant, you know, when you're taking a medication in a hospital or, you know, at your doctor's surgery. But it's not like that at all. It's actually, you know, each day we'll have expectations about something like what we're eating, what activities we're doing. They're going to shape really important outcomes. The result that really surprised me and kind of inspired me to write the book was this finding from 2002 that people who have a positive view of aging, so people who see, they might recognize, you know, some of the downsides of aging, but they also see the good sides of it too, that actually, you know, retirement can be a time of new opportunity and growth. And that actually your wisdom, like scientific measures of like decision-making improve with age as people get older. And the people who recognize those benefits of aging and embrace them are likely to live around 7.5 years longer than the people who assume their life is just going to get worse as they get older. Now, that sounds like the kind of study that I would have been, you know, pretty skeptical of. And I was. I mean, the methods used in the study were perfectly sound, and it was based on a big sample of people. They'd found that people's beliefs in, you know, these were measured before any illnesses had developed, you know, in middle age. And they'd then controlled for, you know, people's health at that stage. And they still found this effect. So that was, it was a good study as far as it went. But it's been replicated just so many times since then. And my criteria is always like, do we have signs of expectation effects from, you know, multiple labs using multiple techniques? And do we have good mechanistic explanations for this? Like, we're not, you know, we're not just drawing on this kind of pseudoscientific law of attraction or something. And it was plausible. I mean, there were, you know, they've very neatly delineated the kind of the different pathways, and, you know, some of it could be behavior, which is a really important pathway, in that if people have a more positive view of aging, they're more likely to look after their bodies and to do exercise. But equally, when you look at people's stress responses, you see a very clear relationship. So people who see aging as this kind of negative process, who fear, you know, the decline in disability, they start to feel very vulnerable when they're doing all kinds of daily tasks. You know, going to the shops comes to feel more dangerous, meeting new people, traveling to a new location. And then that causes them to have a steady rise in cortisol, the stress hormone, which in turn triggers inflammation. And you can see this when you chart these people as they age. It's both of those physiological factors increase as they get older. And both of those are then going to predispose someone to greater illness. So over, you know, years and decades, they're more likely to develop something like Alzheimer's or heart disease than someone who has the positive mindset. Because with those people, you see that actually stress levels and inflammation decrease as they get older.
It was such a profound part of the book. I hadn't been aware of this. And since we met in the summer and we spoke at Cheltenham Science Festival, Rachel and I have been jumping about saying, oh, look, I've got some new grey hair, and I'm really pleased with that. Right. We tried to make it a feature of daily life, of thinking, how am I How am I getting on? You know, I'm looking forward to the future and the opportunities that it, and that does have to feel like it's an active process to do that. But then that actually inspired me over the summer to read more about the Blue Zones and Dan Buettner's work, looking at these pockets of longevity. So thank you for that inspiration. That started me off in that direction. But what seemed to be present there that really connected back to your work in the expectation effect was the role of older people, that they felt like they had purpose, they felt like they still had function, and that they could see as they went from sort of grandmother to great-grandmother that their role and their wisdom was even more respected. And so I could sort of see how that could perpetuate that particular amplification of longevity, or equally, if people were lonely, if people found things hard, if they thought, I won't go to the shops, I'll get a delivery, that it just erodes that physical activity step by step and sends people down into a very different spiral.
Yeah, totally. I visited one of the Blue Zones in Sardinia, and I found those people very inspiring because, you know, they were still living a very active social life, you know, into their 90s and then their 100s, and they were really valued by the community. And I think that then, you know, when you're seeing that, even when you're growing up, when you're younger, you're developing this view of aging that actually it's something to be embraced and celebrated. And I think that's what we see with this research on the expectation effect concerning aging, is that people are internalizing these kind of age stereotypes at a very young age. And it might not start to impact your health until you reach middle age or say like a landmark birthday. But the fact is, because you might, before you reach that, you might just be prejudiced to old people, but think it doesn't concern yourself because you're young. And then you reach that age point and suddenly you think, well, this applies to me. All those awful things I've been thinking about older people are now, you know, are now applying to me. And that's when, you know, life gets a lot more stressful and depressing, and that has the health consequences.
Mm. And you found it on a much more micro level, didn't you? The ability to take on cognitive exercises. You could present information beforehand that would help and hinder the ability to undertake a particular brain training task as well.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So I think, you know, maybe they're not so popular now, but I think 10 years ago, you'd see a lot of these apps on like the, I think it's the Nintendo DS and, you know, all kinds of consoles and smartphones that promise to train your brain. And a lot of scientific research initially seemed to back this up. They showed that people did show kind of IQ gains after they'd performed those that brain training. But then this like really smart study from, I think it was 2015, questioned whether actually this was just an expectation effect caused by the way those scientific trials had been advertised, because they were being advertised as an opportunity for you to try brain training. So the people who were going into the lab doing those games were expecting to have an increase in their cognitive ability. And then lo and behold, they did better on these tasks than people who were just doing this kind of neutral, you know, like activity that didn't feel very convincing, you know, like watching a lecture on a DVD or, you know, something like that. It didn't feel so kind of high tech and like, so it lowered their expectations of improvement. So what this researcher did, he did a meta-analysis of those previous studies, looking at which ones had overtly advertised participation in a brain training experiment, and he found that actually the improvements were much more likely in the ones that had used the overt advertising. And then he performed his own trial in which he recruited people through two separate posters. Some were just told they were going to come in to the lab and just to do some kind of, I can't remember how it was phrased, but it was some neutral description of the tasks. And the others were, you know, advertised overtly again as brain training. It was a chance to kind of boost your cognitive potential. And yeah, he found that then those people who had been primed with the positive expectations increased by about 5 IQ points after doing this 1 hour training compared to people who hadn't been primed with that positive expectation.
It's a fascinating finding, and it gets me curious as to what's genuinely happening there every day for people. Are we going into tasks with a sort of a self-defeatist approach, or this is just mundane? Or if we go into something thinking this is going to be developmental, this is going to be an opportunity for me, that you're actually just seeing your potential being lived out. You're getting what you're capable of, as opposed to the negative preconditions actually reducing your capabilities. That's what that sort of gets me wondering about, rather than it being any artificial boosting. I'm always suspicious of athletes thinking, I'm going to get something extra that I'm not expecting if I believe it. But I'm always very keen for athletes to be able to get what they know that they can do in competition.
I mean, that's very much how I see it. Is that often we're carrying around negative expectations of what we can achieve. And that those are, you know, then they're acting as like brakes on our performance and our potential growth. And by shifting our expectations, we're just kind of releasing those brakes. That's why I try to be really clear in the expectation effect. Like, I'm not saying that, like, if you've been like if you're someone like me who's like enjoys fitness, but I'm not a natural athlete, and especially at my age of like 38, I cannot go to the gym and try to visualize, I don't know, like Tom Daley or, I don't know, Usain Bolt, and then get on the treadmill and expect to like just like blast all my previous personal bests. Like, something unrealistic like that is just not going to be helpful. But what I have found helpful and what the research shows is that actually, you know, in the past, I'd been overly negative about my potential for fitness. So I'd assumed that I had bad genes that were going to hold me back and that maybe I would just, you know, put in a lot of effort without getting anything out of it. It had been, I'd based that on, you know, how I'd kind of experienced PE lessons at school. You know, I'd always find them like quite unpleasant. And, you know, I just assumed I would always be kind of bad at fitness. But actually, like, you know, so I just reappraised those particular expectations and was just like, actually, there's nothing about my body that is like inherently bad at exercise. And that actually, there's so much abundant scientific proof that the more you put in, the more you get out of it. So even if I'll never compete in the Olympics, I'm going to improve slowly day by day, and I can focus on that trajectory. And when I'm on the treadmill and I'm feeling a bit uncomfortable, I can change those feelings of discomfort. I can change my appraisal of those feelings of discomfort from something that is undesirable, that's taken as evidence of my lack of fitness, and I can instead see them as something positive. They're a sign of my growth. It's a sign that I'm actually, when my muscles are aching, that's a sign that I'm building strength. When I'm out of breath, that's a sign that I'm pushing my heart and my lungs just a bit further so that it's ultimately going to increase their capacity. Now, what the research shows and I experienced is that that can make the whole experience of exercise more pleasant. Like, it reduces the perceived exertion. So you don't feel that you're working out so hard. You don't feel so exhausted in the moment. It can also have benefits, you know, for objective measures of stamina and even some physiological measures of what's happening in your body. So things like how efficient your lungs are at exchanging carbon dioxide for oxygen, the efficiency of your movements, like whether you're kind of moving further by burning less energy, all of that can be affected by these expectations as well. And in no way did I have to be deceptive to myself or to believe, you know, that I was more capable than I really was. But I was just changing my interpretation of what I was capable of and my interpretation of what I was experiencing.
You should get a job in this area. We should get you in front of some athletes. You could certainly help them. Right. Because so a couple of things there that, you know, this sort of mythological mother deadlifting a car away from a trapped child, for example, that sense of some supernatural gift from up on high that enabled them to do that. To me, that just sounds like somebody that could have deadlifted a car if they really wanted to, and they were naturally strong and able to do that. You probably don't hear of the examples of where the mother tried to but couldn't, because it's not as pleasant. The research that I think is relevant here is that if you take elite athletes and recreational exercises, when they provide them with a pain stimulus, that the elite athletes are able to distract themselves away from it. They experience the same level of pain.
Yeah.
They have a coping mechanism, and they have a way of distracting. And there was a study that I haven't seen repeated, but was quite compelling in its idea about efficiency of running, so economy of movement on a treadmill. And actually, a lot of exercise physiologists like myself probably have to be aware of what you're saying when you've got somebody on a treadmill, because the study found that if you drew attention to running technique, if you drew attention to breathing, for example, it actually made economy worse. But if you ask them to be thinking about the outdoors, thinking about, you know, something they really enjoy, you distracted them with a nice outdoor scene on a TV. Mm. It distracted them away from things and made it less conscious, and actually made it easier. And so that sense of being able to use the mind to just simply reframe the experience.
Let
me ask you a little bit about willpower. So limitless willpower, really interesting chapter about this idea that you've potentially got a fatiguing ability to make decisions and do that well through the day. What were some of the major findings that and practical implications that people can benefit from in terms of preserving their ability to make good decisions?
Yeah, I mean, so there had been in the past this idea of ego depletion, which, you know, kind of goes back to Freud, although he, you know, spoke about it quite vaguely. But it's this idea that you have this kind of, you know, part of your psyche, the ego, that is trying to rein in the id, which is all about impulsivity, and it's trying to, you know, meet the goals of the superego that, you know, wants you to kind of achieve higher things. And so, but, you know, Freud has suggested that actually the ego kind of needs energy to do so. And so when this idea was resuscitated in the 90s, the idea was that, you know, Freud was talking maybe metaphorically, but actually, like, in the brain, it looked like self-control actually took energy. It takes glucose for it to be able to exert control. And the more you exert self-control, the more the ego becomes depleted, to the point that eventually impulsivity takes over. So you can't focus your attention or resist temptation to achieve those bigger goals. It's very interesting that research happened in the West, because in countries like India, they had a different view of willpower, which was that actually willpower can be self-sustaining. that it's you kind of get into the zone when you're doing a task, and you actually find it easier to maintain your willpower to avoid distraction the more you go on. Same if you avoiding the temptation of eating cookies, it might be really tough for the first day, but then it's like you kind of built that into your way of thinking, so the next day it's going to become easier. Now what the latest research has shown is that actually both of those mindsets are correct, because they both become self-fulfilling prophecies. So if someone really is invested and believes in this idea of ego depletion, and they think that their willpower is very limited, well, then they actually experience ego depletion in these laboratory tasks and then in their day-to-day lives. If they have a stressful day at work, they really are more likely to go and have, you know, junk food after work and then to watch TV and skip the gym. Whereas people who have the non-limited view of willpower, the one that's closer to the kind of cultural beliefs of the people in India, they tend to experience the opposite. They actually find it easier to maintain their kind of focus as they get into a task. It actually empowers them. So if they, you know, if a kid is at school and they're moving from one piece of homework to the other, they will actually perform better on the second piece of homework because they've already kind of built up their willpower in the first piece of homework, which is very difficult for, I think, most kids in the UK to believe. But what Veronica Yorb, who I think she's based now at the University of Vienna, what she had shown is that these mindsets can be manipulated, and simply by teaching people about the possibility of this non-limited willpower mindset, just teaching people that actually this is possible for you to maintain your willpower and for it to grow as you practice it, can be very beneficial to people, and it can actually then help, you know, create a new self-fulfilling prophecy.
That's fascinating. It's just a simple reframe or skill development to be able to think about yourself as resourceful and capable, as opposed to a cultural or preconceived idea that, you know, you'll diminish through the day. Very interesting. And look, this has been so fascinating to chat to you, tap into these areas that you're researching. Do you tell yourself when you're writing and you're finding you've got writer's block, do you tell yourself, well, it's all going to come now because I've got unlimited willpower and it's all going to come now and it's all going to happen after my second stint of the day?
I do. And also, I think, and this is maybe something that I did learn from my maths degree as well, which is that I think that trained me to reframe frustration before I was aware of all of this research. And the fact is that frustration is like an agonizing emotion to be feeling, like whether you're unable to solve this maths problem or unable to kind of come up with a good idea on the way to build this narrative in a chapter. But you can see frustration as just an inevitable part of the creative process. It's actually the feeling of being creative, I think. If I was doing a very different task like admin, I wouldn't really feel frustrated because it would be very easy. You know, it's a very logical sequence of steps to do without that need for new insights or for making new connections. So I see frustration as being the feeling of your brain struggling to make those new connections. And the research shows, and it's what I experience, is that once you embrace frustration in that way, it helps you, it actually helps those answers to come more quickly. I think that was what I learned in my maths degree, was as soon as I allowed myself to panic, like that was when I was going to have like big problems with like completing my assignments. And it's the same with writing. It's just having the faith that it will come and liberating yourself to try all of those different avenues, accepting that some will fail, but just knowing that maybe you'll eventually find the one that does work, and to know that you actually have to go through those failures to find that one that will work.
Love that. Love that. Well, thank you for feeling those frustrations and working through that and writing your books. Are you allowed to say what your next topic is about, or is that should we just leave it suspenseful for next time?
No, absolutely. So my next book is called the Laws of Connection, and it comes out in early June 2024. And it's looking at the science of being social and how that can transform our lives. So first of all, it's looking at why being social is so important for us as a species, and particularly for our health. There's lots of research showing that engaging in social activities is as good for our health as things like exercising or eating a healthy diet or whether or not you smoke. You know, it's really important for, you know, all kinds of different measures of health. You know, how likely you are to die from cardiovascular disease, how likely you are to catch a cold even, or develop diabetes. You know, so many different measures all support this view that we could all do with being a little bit more sociable and forming deeper, meaningful relationships. That's really the key here, is it's not just having those superficial kind of or instrumental friendships you might have with people, but it's actually feeling a sense of proper connection with them. And then the rest of the book looks at how we can go about that. And what I've uncovered by looking at all of the scientific research is that we often have lots of faulty intuitions, these kind of social cognitive biases that prevent us from forming those relationships. We would all actually have a lot more potential to have a much stronger, more comforting, supportive social network if we only corrected these negative expectations. And then I'll show you how to do that.
Can't wait. Can't wait to read it. sounds fantastic. Look, thank you so much, David. I really appreciate the conversation. So enlightening, so informed. And yeah, thank you so much.
No, thank you. I've learned a lot as well. So thanks for sharing your perspectives.
Thank you so much for taking the time to listen. I really hope you enjoyed this week's conversation. Now, we've got plenty more to come. So if you'd like to support and champion us, then take the time to subscribe and leave a review on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, YouTube, or wherever you tune in. You can also give us a follow on Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. All the links are in the show notes. So in the meantime, have a great week.